My name is Richard Bush. Ken Lieberthal, the director of our John L. Thornton China Center, and I are very pleased to welcome you to Brookings today for this special event, Obama Goes to Asia. Our lead-off speaker is our good friend and former colleague, Jeffrey Bader, Special Assistant to the President for National Security Affairs and Director of Asian Affairs on the National Security Council. You came to hear him, not to hear me, so without further ado, I give you Jeffrey Bader.
Thank you very much, Richard. Delighted to be back at Brookings, coming here after almost about a one-year absence. I was concerned I wouldn't find many old friends here, but it turns out, amazingly, I still have almost as many friends from Brookings here at 1775 Massachusetts Avenue as I have friends from Brookings in the administration. Acknowledgments of close friends, Strobe Talbot, Richard Bush, Ken Lieberthal, and Chung Lee. I've followed Strobe around from job to job for the past 15 years with good reason. It would be impossible to find a better or more congenial colleague and supervisor. And Ken, Chung Lee, and Richard were my special colleagues at the John L. Thornton China Center and CNAPS before I left Brookings. I'm pleased to see all the good work they've done since I left. Ken and Richard have asked me to talk about the forthcoming trip by President Obama to East Asia. One always accepts these invitations with trepidation. The role of staff at the National Security Council is to advise the President and to coordinate the interagency process. It is not to make news. So I'll try to walk the fine line today between being utterly boring and producing stories that then have to be explained away. That said, in a democratic society, we do not pursue our foreign policy goals and objectives from behind a wall. We want you to hear what we are thinking, and we want to hear what you are thinking. So, trepidation aside, it is good and right to be here on this occasion. President Obama entered office with a daunting domestic agenda, including the biggest domestic economic crisis facing this country since the 1930s, and health care and energy. With such an agenda, there has been much written about the reduced bandwidth that goes with crises, with the implication that the President would not have much time for foreign policy. In fact, with his trip to Asia, President Obama will have visited 20 countries in his first year in office, the most of any president in history. He has done this not because he is filled with wanderlust. Rather, he has done so because the international agenda, including wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, Iranian and the North Korean nuclear programs, climate change, and an international economic crisis, is no less daunting than the domestic agenda and cannot wait. He also believes it is essential to restore American leadership, influence, image, and standing in a world where all have suffered in recent years. The problems we face are simply too complex to be solved by any one country, no matter how strong. The President has recognized that we need active partners around the world to tackle them, and building those partnerships is not something that can be done sitting in the Oval Office. Which brings me to this trip and what we are looking to accomplish. Let me begin by sketching out the East Asian landscape that the President will be encountering and how it looks to us. The importance of Asia has been rising dramatically in the last decade or two. You know the numbers that illustrate the point. I won't go into them here. China's rise is the most visible manifestation of Asia's rise, but far from the only one. During the period of Asia's emergence, the U.S. has been substantially occupied with various fronts in the war on terror. The U.S. also went on a domestic spending and overseas borrowing spree that proved to be unsustainable. These phenomena have persuaded many Asians that the U.S. is overextended and distracted. In some quarters, notably but not exclusively in China, there has been a steady stream of articles and speculation that the U.S. is a declining power. I believe reports of America's demise are, as they say, considerably exaggerated and will look rather foolish in a few years. I can recall in the 1970s much literature about the end of the bipolar world and the emergence of a multipolar world. In the last decade, we had colorful additions to the language like rising Chindia, designed to demonstrate that our time had passed. The U.S. is without question an Asia-Pacific nation, but it will remain an Asia-Pacific power not by loud assertions that it is so, but by demonstrating it through conduct and presence. What does that entail? Now, first of all, it means modernizing and strengthening our alliances. Populations in our key allies in Northeast Asia support the alliances, but they want more equal partnerships with a lighter U.S. military footprint. That is why we are reconfiguring our presence in Japan and South Korea. In neither case will our forward military presence be reduced, but in both cases it will be more acceptable to the populations whose security it contributes to so importantly. It does so not simply by waiting for military action, for which we hope there is no need. Rather, our active presence helps promote security, dampen sources of instability, deters conflict, and gives substance to U.S. security commitments. We have made a particular point of close consultations with our Asia-Pacific partners since President Obama came into office. I know that close consultations is one of those diplo-speak phrases that causes eyelids to become heavy, and that in practice can amount to a little more than pro forma delivery of talking points. But real consultations, that is, authentic exchanges of view and on strategy, are not trivial. Over the last few years, there have been bruised feelings among our partners in Seoul and Tokyo over what they felt were inadequate consultations on the North Korea issue. From day one, we have been scrupulous about building consensus with our allies on North Korea policy, genuinely soliciting their views, sitting down with them before we made a decision, not just afterwards, and never making a move without thorough discussions. The relationship with Japan, long the cornerstone and still the cornerstone of the U.S. security presence in East Asia, is not one we can take for granted. 50 years after the signing of the U.S.-Japan Treaty on Security and Cooperation, the world has changed, America has changed, and as everyone in this room who have noticed, Japan has changed. For only the second time in 50 years, a party besides the Liberal Democratic Party is in power. The recognition in both capitals that the U.S.-Japan alliance also needs to continue to adapt is what drives the ongoing process of realignment and the review of the alliance by Prime Minister Hatoyama, which we welcome as an important step towards alliance renewal. With new governments in place, the time is ripe for our resilient alliance to be reaffirmed. The foreign policy platform of the Democratic Party of Japan called for a more equal partnership with the U.S. It raised questions about the Futenma replacement facility on Okinawa, about the future of refueling provided to allies fighting in Afghanistan, and about other aspects of the security relationship. 6 or 7 weeks into its debut in governance, the new Japanese leadership is assessing all these questions. At the same time, Prime Minister Hatoyama has said repeatedly that he considers the alliance with the U.S. as the key relationship in Japanese foreign policy. President Obama and Prime Minister Hatoyama had a warm meeting in New York and have spoken on the phone, getting their relationship off to a good start. In their meeting last month in the U.N. and in subsequent high-level meetings, we demonstrated that we can listen to a critically important ally, understand its political needs, and articulate our thinking in ways that we hope will be persuasive to Tokyo. Our approach is meant to ensure that the alliance is not reduced to a series of difficult negotiations and transactions, when in fact it is a bond understood as critical to both our nations, requiring sacrifices of narrow self-interest. We will need to be persistent and clear as we deal with some of the complex alliance issues in the months ahead. As we do so, we both need to keep our eye on the larger picture. That is how much the U.S.-Japan alliance means for both of us, both regionally and globally. Americans should not forget what Japan does on global issues is often critically important to us. Besides the U.S., there has been no larger contributor, for example, in foreign assistance to Pakistan and Afghanistan than Japan. Japan is a model of energy efficiency and is playing an important role in the climate change negotiations. President Obama has paid particular attention to our relationship with South Korea and has established a shared vision with President Lee Myung-bak on the U.S.-South Korea alliance and our broader partnership. The notion of a rift between the U.S. and South Korea that was rampant a few years ago is gone. Our relationship is on a solid footing. Seoul was a key stop on the itinerary of Secretary of State Clinton's first overseas trip, as well as on visits by the Secretary of Defense and other top U.S. officials. President Lee was warmly greeted at the White House in June with the trappings of a state visit, and our two presidents have spoken on the phone and in person a number of times. Not only have we worked closely together in fashioning a unified response to the North Korean missile and nuclear provocations, we have done so in a way that takes into account Seoul's special equities and inter-Korean relations. We are modernizing the alliance. I'd recommend you look at the joint vision statement issued when President Lee visited the U.S. in June to see where we're going and how we're getting there. We have worked with the South Korean government as it has expanded its international presence in Afghanistan, where it has just announced its intention to establish a new provincial reconstruction team, in the Indian Ocean, where it is active in multilateral anti-piracy operations, and in the Group of 20, which Seoul will host next year. Our troop presence in South Korea is steady and will be improved in the years to come as base relocation projects move forward and U.S. service members increasingly are able to bring their families with them when they deploy. We remain committed to the U.S.-Korea Free Trade Agreement. Our respective trade officials are working to narrow outstanding differences. I'd like to mention briefly one other key alliance in the region, Australia. President Obama and Prime Minister Kevin Rudd have formed a strong personal bond already, meeting frequently in the Oval Office and at the G20 meetings. This relationship has helped encourage the strong support we have received from Australia on numerous issues, not least the 40% increase in its troop presence in Afghanistan and close coordination on issues including global warming and economic recovery. Second, it means getting the relationship with China right. I've experienced a number of American presidential transitions in my time in government, several of which went rather badly. This one has been different, and that is no accident. Past difficult transitions led to negative consequences for U.S. national security interests. We have avoided that trap. President Obama did so by reaching out personally, early and often, to President Hu, by meeting with him twice, by establishing the strategic and economic dialogue that met for the first time in late July, by scheduling a visit to China in November, and by making clear his intention to work closely with China in addressing the key global challenges I mentioned earlier. None of these challenges can be addressed without intensive involvement by China. Our cooperation has been especially close and effective in dealing with the North Korea nuclear problem, where China has helped pass a strong UN Security Council resolution, worked with us in implementing it, and made its opposition to North Korea's nuclear program increasingly clear and sharp. At the same time as we have demonstrated to the Chinese our good faith in resolving to cooperate with them, we have made clear that our commitment to human rights and democracy is a permanent U.S. value, indeed one that will be advanced more effectively under an Obama administration that understands that the value of example is more effective than the value of finger-pointing. We also intend to follow the Taiwan Relations Act in ensuring the defense of Taiwan. And we have worked to strengthen U.S. alliances and other partnerships in the region, while at the same time we are seeking to strengthen military relations with China and put them on a more durable basis. During his visit to China, I anticipate the President will be talking to the Chinese about a breadth of issues that demonstrate the reality that none of the great issues of the day can be addressed without Chinese cooperation: arms control and nonproliferation, North Korea and Iranian nuclear programs, climate change and clean energy, rebuilding the global economy on a sustainable and balanced basis, Afghanistan and Pakistan, human rights and democracy. We know that building a durable and stable relationship with China, the most dramatically rising power of the century, will be neither straightforward nor simple, and will require both toughness and adaptability on our part. Trust and confidence will need to be built by word and action. They cannot be assumed. Third, we have sought to convey to our friends in Southeast Asia that we are back. President Obama spent years in his youth in Indonesia, so he has a special understanding and feeling for the region. Southeast Asians have felt neglected in recent years as our relationship has been defined largely by cooperation in the war on terror. That is a necessary but not sufficient basis for a relationship. We have undertaken steps that have given new attention to the region. Secretary Clinton signed the Treaty on Amity and Cooperation, something that ASEAN has been seeking from the U.S. for two decades. She attended the ASEAN Regional Forum meeting in Phuket in July. She was the first Secretary of State to visit the ASEAN Regional Headquarters in Jakarta, and the State Department has announced that it will name a Jakarta-based ambassador to ASEAN, the first one so designated by any country. We are building a comprehensive partnership with Indonesia and building a warmer relationship with Malaysia. We have reaffirmed our commitment to our allies in Thailand and the Philippines. President Obama will hold the first ever presidential meeting with the heads of state and government of the ASEAN 10 during his visit to Singapore later this month. In a continent filled with countries seeking to improve the lives of their people and relations with their neighbors, two exceptions stand out, and we will be talking to our allies and partners about both on this trip, North Korea and Burma. North Korea has pursued a policy over the 9 months that President Obama has been in office, which I'd characterize by recalling Abba Ibn's classic phrase when talking about an Israeli adversary of his time. They never miss an opportunity to miss an opportunity. President Obama came into office making clear he was prepared to deal with adversaries. As a general matter, and in particular, he signaled willingness to engage with North Korea, both directly and through six-party talks, to help them find a way through denuclearization to acceptance in the international community and a better life for their people. Instead, dusting off its old playbook, North Korea abrogated its agreements, launched ballistic missiles, conducted a nuclear test, resumed reprocessing of spent fuel, and threatened its neighbors. Once the cycle of provocations was complete, North Korea sat back to await a new and improved package of concessions from the U.S. Instead, in response, in close cooperation with our partners, we have passed a U.N. Security Council resolution imposing new sanctions against North Korea. But more importantly, we have implemented it. We have presented a united front toward Pyongyang, along with the other members of the six parties and the international community, in demanding that North Korea halt provocations and commit seriously and demonstrably to denuclearization. The result has been to make it significantly more difficult for North Korea to conduct financial transactions to support its weapons of mass destruction programs, to sell or buy arms, or to proliferate WMD technology. We are prepared to engage directly with the North Koreans. The Obama administration believes it is better to hear directly from others, including adversaries, than to hear from them secondhand through a filter. But we are not interested in talks for talk's sake. We are not interested in buying Yongbyon for a third time. We are not interested in indulging North Korea's dream of validation as a self-proclaimed nuclear power. We are ready to talk to North Korea in the context of the six-party talks with the explicit goal of denuclearization and with recognition that its previous commitments to denuclearize and return to the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, notably those in 2005, remain valid. The other regional problem I alluded to earlier, Burma, will be on display during the President's stop in Singapore. For two decades, the Burmese regime has isolated itself by overturning election results, imprisoning thousands, including Aung San Suu Kyi, for political reasons, spurning dialogue with the opposition that won the last contested election, and ruling by military fiat. Its closed economy has stagnated, while those around it have prospered. The U.S. and the international community have responded with sanctions and kept the Burmese regime at arm's length. While such an approach has been necessary to demonstrate our commitment to the democratic movement in Burma and its long-suffering citizens, it has seemed paradoxically to suit the needs of Burma's xenophobic military leaders. President Obama has directed us to try something different because, as Secretary Clinton has pointed out, the policies of the international community have not in two decades produced positive results. One definition of insanity is to do the same thing over and over and expect a different outcome. 20 years is long enough. So we are now pursuing a direct diplomatic dialogue with Burma. We have had two exchanges led by Assistant Secretary of State Kurt Campbell, including earlier this week in Burma. We will have more. In that dialogue, we are laying out our expectations for a Burma that is democratic and protects the rights of its people. We are making clear sanctions will be lifted only in response to concrete actions by the Burmese. We are also making clear that our engagement will not be only with the leadership, but with important actors in Burmese civil society outside the government, including Aung San Suu Kyi and the opposition. This process will take time to produce results, and indeed results are not guaranteed. It has taken the Burmese military 5 decades of rule to reach the present unhappy point. We will need patience and persistence to alter the results of 50 years of history, pursuing a path consistent with our interests and values as we seek to do so. Through President Obama's trip, I think it will be vividly clear to the peoples of Asia that the U.S. is here to stay in Asia. Asians want us to be there for a host of reasons, and we need to be there for our own reasons. The rise of Asia in the last few decades may not have made as many headlines as other strife-torn parts of the world, but in the long run, it will be more consequential. We are a vital contributor to Asian security and economic success. Asia, in turn, has a profound impact on our lives through trade, through our alliances and partnerships, and through the immigrants who have come to the U.S. to enormously enrich our country in every domain. As Asia continues to grow and as new groupings and structures take shape, the U.S. will be a player and participant on the ground floor, not a distant spectator. Our first president to have grown up in the Pacific region and who spent some of his formative years in Indonesia understands this in personal as well as abstract terms. For this audience, which cares so much about America's relationship with Asia, whether you agree or disagree with everything we do, I am confident you will see an administration that gives priority to Asia and that strives to strengthen ties so vital to our national interest. Thank you all very much for your attention. I look forward to your questions and comments.
Thank you, Jeff, for that comprehensive scene setter for the President's trip. We have about 20 minutes for questions. When you're called on, please identify yourself, wait for the mic, ask your question briefly. Thank you. Chris Nelson.
Thanks very much, Chris Nelson, Nelson Report. Jeff, I hate to ask you to commit news, but let me give it a try. You talk about North Korea and what we are prepared to do, and you note that they greeted the Obama administration by, in a sense, escalating and not doing. Now they're in one of their periodic charm offensives. There's a school of thought that we've learned the hard way if we don't react to a charm offensive by reaching out to them, then we go back in one of those negative cycles. So my question, do you define as talks about talks sending Steve Bosworth to North Korea to find out if they're prepared to talk about coming back to the Sixth Party? Are we prepared to take that first step of sending him to develop the situation, or are we going to wait until we've heard definitively in some way, yeah, we're coming back to the Sixth Party, and only then will we send Bosworth? Thanks.
Well, Chris, we're very clear that we are prepared to have both bilateral and six-party talks with the North Koreans, that any bilateral talks must be in the context of the six-party talks and the associated agreements. So there is no problem in principle with our engaging with the North Koreans. We would not bilaterally in the context I just described. There has not been a decision yet about when and how that will happen. We've had discussions with our partners about how and when. We've had discussions with the North Koreans, as you know. Lee Gun was in town, was not in this town. He was in New York and San Diego a week or two ago, and we've had discussions with them. We're interested less in process than we are in outcome. We want to see genuine signs that the North Koreans understand that the six-party process is the right framework, that denuclearization is the agenda, that the 2005 agreements remain binding on all parties, including North Korea. If that and that North Korea is prepared to go through a path to international acceptance by pursuing a serious denuclearization agenda. If we see that, then there is no problem with bilateral contacts either in Pyongyang or elsewhere.
Scott Harrell.
Scott Harrell of the RAND Corporation. Jeff, you correctly noted that this administration has very smoothly and effectively integrated with the Chinese or talked with the Chinese through the transition. But at the same time, the Chinese have seemingly given some cover to North Korea. You noticed, I'm sure, Premier Wen was in Pyongyang. And then the very next few days, the North Korean regime tested missiles. I'm wondering if you can give us a feel for the flavor of the interactions you're getting with the Chinese leadership over their sense of where we need to go on proliferation generally. You didn't talk about Iran, but that would be another area.
Scott, good to see you. The consultations and the conversations with the Chinese on North Korea have been extremely intensive and in-depth since day one. There is no subject that has more preoccupied us in our relationship with China than North Korea. President Obama has made several phone calls to presidents who, if you did a pie chart on how much time was spent on issues, North Korea would dominate. I would say that we have welcomed and been pleased with the Chinese approach on North Korea. The Chinese have been adamant that there is no country that is more opposed to North Korea's nuclear program than China is. They have said that. They have said that convincingly. As you know, they worked with us on the statements by the UN Security Council in response to the so-called satellite launch, which basically closed the satellite launch loophole in previous UN resolutions. They then supported Resolution 1874 in response to the nuclear test, which has allowed us to sanction something like 15 or 16 North Korean entities to ban North Korean arms trade, put in place a whole series of sanctions that didn't exist before. We've worked with the Chinese in implementing those sanctions. I have no doubt that the Chinese are serious when they say they will not tolerate a nuclear North Korea in the long run. That is their strategic objective. They understand how damaging it is to their own strategic interests and their relations with surrounding countries. You mentioned Wen Jiabao's visit. Wen Jiabao did come back with a new statement from Kim Jong-il about North Korean willingness to return to the six-party talks under certain conditions. We welcomed Premier Wen's visit and what he came back with, and we're evaluating it, talking to our partners about whether we can proceed in that respect. So, by and large, I think we have a high level of satisfaction with how we're doing with the Chinese on North Korea. Our perspectives are not identical. North Korea is a neighbor of China. It's not a neighbor of the U.S. We have forward deployed troops in the area that creates different perspectives. But the overlap of our interests, I think, is very substantial.
Hi, my name's Seth, and I'm not affiliated with any think tank. I'm just here of my own interest. My question is actually about our relationship with China and the Obama administration's significant emphasis on the climate change issue. My perspective is, although people both in China and the United States care a lot about that issue, that in terms of the bilateral relationship, there's more angst about the deficits in both countries. I mean, there's this angry youth movement, I think, in China, and I think, obviously, in the United States, it's also a big issue. Are we putting too much emphasis on climate change relative to the deficit in trade in terms of actually, not that those aren't important issues, but in terms of our bilateral discussions with the Chinese? And if not, what's your opinion on how we can address some of the angry youth movement in China and those issues?
You're asking a question about priorities, and those are always difficult questions. We like to believe that we can walk and chew gum at the same time, and we can concentrate on the global economic balance issues to which you alluded, and also deal with the long-term climate change challenge to the planet, which there's a consensus is threatening to all of us. I think we've been struck by the degree to which China's position on this issue has evolved in the last few years. 4 or 5 years ago, the Chinese were somewhere between skeptical and indifferent to the climate change challenge. And somewhere around 2006, we began seeing much more serious studies and evaluation by Chinese institutions of the impact that climate change was having on China. I think that evolution in Chinese thinking is continuing. I do consider climate change one of the top issues in the relationship. I'm very pleased that Brookings and my colleague Ken Lieberthal have been so active on this issue, because there is simply no way we're going to have a global accord on climate change or make any significant progress if the world's two biggest emitters, the U.S. and China, are not somewhere within the same universe on the subject. So cooperation between U.S. and China it's not an option. It's necessary if we're to do anything on this issue. So we can't put that sort of at the back of the train and say we'll take care of other issues and deal with that later on. We simply don't have the luxury.
The woman in black, and then I'll come up here. Right there.
Hi, thanks. Margaret Tolliv with McClatchy Newspapers. I was hoping that you could describe for us President Obama's sort of public speaking plans in China. We've heard there may be a town hall, there may be a formal university speech. Can you talk about what he and the Chinese government have agreed to and how he'll deal with issues like democracy and human rights in those remarks?
Yeah, I'd rather not get into the details of the schedule yet, which is still under discussion and which will be announced before too long. But the president certainly will have opportunities to speak to non-official Chinese as well as official Chinese, and he will speak publicly in a variety of settings in China. During those public appearances, President Obama will be reaching out to the Chinese people. This is an opportunity for him to connect with people without going through official intermediaries. And I personally believe there's no one better at this. I think we saw this in 2008 in the campaign, what his communications skills are. With ordinary people as opposed to officials. President Obama we have tried to structure opportunities for President Obama to use those special communications gifts, which he has, to speak about the challenges for Americans and Chinese, particularly Americans, young Americans and Chinese, to work together on common challenges in the 21st century, at the same time to talk about our country, how our country works, how we've gotten where we are, our strengths and our weaknesses, and to let others draw their own conclusions about what works for them based on this description of what works for us. President Obama's approach to human rights and democracy is multifaceted. Okay, I think that the first element in it is sort of the axiom, physician, heal thyself, that you set a good example. And by setting a good example, you make the U.S. A more attractive model for other countries. And so that is what he has been trying to do in human rights policy in this first year, such as in dealing with the Guantanamo issue. He also will speak very directly to Chinese officials. He'll meet with President Hu Jintao, lengthy meetings, meet with Premier Wang Jiabao. He will speak very clearly about U.S. values, democracy and human rights, with emphasis on freedom of expression and religion, protection of minority rights, access to information, rule of law, these kinds of issues. I admit I'm prejudiced, okay, having been in the Obama campaign and now working in the Obama administration. My view is that when someone is admired and is popular and is seen positively, the message that he is bringing is more likely to resonate than it is when someone is seen as hostile and adversarial. President Obama is enormously popular in all the countries that he's visiting. I haven't seen the latest polls, but the numbers I've seen are staggering. When you have someone who has that degree of respect and affection and admiration, the message that he is bringing is much more likely to resonate than when you come in with a 5% approval rating. So I think we have a great gift and a great opportunity through President Obama to sell ourselves in the world.
Woman right here.
Hi, I'm Stephanie Klein-Albrand. I'm with the International Crisis Group in Beijing. I would be grateful if you could perhaps speak a bit to the types of discussions you're having with the Chinese with regard to Iran.
Well, China is a member of the so-called P5 plus one. That's the permanent five members of the Security Council plus Germany that have been in talks with Iran for quite some time on how to provide assurance that Iran's nuclear program is peaceful. China has been part of every round of talks. We have conference calls all the time among the P5 plus one on next steps. I was out in Pittsburgh for the group of 20 meeting where at the time when the Chinese nuclear reactor in Qom was surfaced, and the Chinese issued a statement at the time expressing concern over the development and calling on the IAEA to investigate and look into the reactor. China has endorsed the so-called dual-track policy with regard to Iran, where we talk to them and try to provide a path for them to demonstrate that their nuclear program is peaceful, but if they do not, the P5 plus one agree that pressure must be increased. China has endorsed that approach, and China is part of that process. Now, that doesn't mean that the U.S. and China have identical perspectives on Iran. China, we have very limited relations with Iran because of the Iran Sanctions Act and because of the unhappy history of the last 30 years. The Chinese have a rather substantial trade and investment relationship with Iran. Iran is China's about fourth or fifth largest supplier of energy. China has substantial growing investments in the oil and gas sector in Iran. So they approach it from a different perspective. They are more reluctant to move towards sanctions and pressure than some other members of the P5 plus one. So there is a certain constant effort to try to align our thinking. But in the final analysis, the Chinese understand that Iran cannot be allowed to get nuclear weapons. It is absolutely contrary to Chinese interests in several respects. First of all, China is increasingly dependent on the Persian Gulf for imported oil. The Persian Gulf will be vastly destabilized by an Iran with nuclear weapons, not to mention the countries that would follow Iran in acquiring nuclear weapons if Iran goes that route. And secondly, the breakdown in the non-proliferation regime and the non-proliferation treaty that an Iranian breakout would signify would mean that nuclear weapons would probably no longer be taboo in other parts of the world, including closer to China. I think that my discussions with the Chinese leadership indicates they understand these factors quite well. So I would say, sort of in summing up, that our position on North Korea has, the cooperation has been closer, and our views have been more closely aligned. But on Iran, there are some differences, but they have been part of the process, and we look for them to continue being part of the process, whichever track we go down, track one or track two.
Mr. Ogawa from Yomiuri Shimbun.
Thank you. I'm Satoshi Ogawa from the Yomiuri Shimbun. And my question is, as you mentioned, Prime Minister Hatoyama is seeking the equal partnership between U.S. and which seems to distance Japan from U.S. So do you think that weaken the U.S.-Japan alliance and benefit China? And according to the Washington Post article, U.S. senior official told that hardest thing right now is not China, it's Japan. Do you agree with that or disagree?
I don't know who said that. I don't care who said that. Someone may have said it, and it was repeated to a second person, to a third person, to a fourth person, to a fifth person, and it found its way into print somewhere, and suddenly it's a position of somebody. I'm not interested in such statements, okay? Life is too short to track down the origin or the meaning of such asinine statements, okay? The DPJ has been in office for, what, six or seven weeks. First time a party besides the LDP has been in power, except for 1 year in the last 50. It's a coalition that represents a broad range of interests and ideological perspectives. It's not surprising that we're seeing a transition that produces some news stories. Okay, in the United States, we have transitions every 4 years, well, except when the president is reelected, but we have frequent transitions. We're used to the sort of storm and drang of the first 2 or 3 months of an administration where everything gets turned over from the previous administration and new policies are put in place. Japan is not used to that. Japan hasn't had that. Okay? I think it's a healthy development that Japan, great democracy in Asia, is actually experiencing a transition in power and is going through some of the difficulty that we all experience, and which we experience routinely and regularly. Okay, yes, it does make the relationship. It does make managing the relationship it requires more attention and requires sensitivity to different perspectives than we're used to dealing with. But we have complete confidence that this is a party that is committed to the U.S.-Japan relationship, that's committed to the alliance, and that this trip by President Obama will highlight that.
The gentleman in the blue shirt.
I'm Jonathan Weissman with the Wall Street Journal. Hoping you could address some of the economic issues, especially with China, currency issues, rebalancing, and also you mentioned that you were committed to and working through the South Korea Free Trade Agreement. Is there anything the president can offer concretely when he gets to Seoul?
Okay, first of all, on currency and rebalancing, let me be careful, since anyone who besides Tim Geithner, who talks about currency values, no longer has a job the next morning. There's a reason for that. I mean, markets are sensitive things, and when you have 1,000 voices in the administration all offering their personal, educated, and uneducated opinions about currency values, you can drive markets crazy, and I don't intend to do that. But it is an integral part of U.S. policy that China should be moving towards a market-based value for its currency. That is part of our dialogue. That has been part of our dialogue. That will continue to be part of our dialogue. The notion of rebalancing China's economy and the global economy are very much part of our objectives and our dialogue. In the Group of 20 meeting in Pittsburgh, the goal of rebalancing the global economy after recovery, and the notion that the global economy could not pick up where it left off before this crisis began, with the U.S. running massive trade deficits and Asian countries simply importing massive amounts of products to the U.S. and achieving prosperity based on that, on the profligacy of the American consumer, that is not a sustainable model. And that is, we have been very clear to the Chinese about that, that recovery will require different models and different steps by both sides. This is something we each need to do. On the Korean Free Trade Agreement, saying currency, I defer to Tim Geithner. On the FTA, I'm going to defer to Ron Kirk, who was speaking on the record somewhere else today about Korea. But I just say a couple things. Number one, the president is a strong believer in free trade. He sees trade as a good in itself and as a mechanism for producing lots of good American and well-paying American jobs. The president has spoken to President Xi about the FTA. This is something that we want to be able to move ahead on. He has directed his advisors and his cabinet to look for ways to overcome the differences between the two sides. And this is something that we hope to move forward on. We want to ensure that the FTA does provide adequate access for U.S. automobiles to the Korean market. But the timing of when this can be done and what is politically feasible in a very political the very political context surrounding trade that we deal with, that's a question above my pay grade.
John Zhang in the back.
John Zhang with CTI TV of Taiwan. This is probably the first presidential visit to China in 15 years in the context of improved relationship across the Taiwan Strait and relaxed tension. I was wondering whether or not the president will, whether there will be anything new in the president's approach to the Taiwan issue, and how would he respond to President Hu's likely calls for the U.S. to respect China's core interest and reduce or stop arms sales to Taiwan? Thank you very much.
I appreciate the question, and I think your observation is exactly right. The cross-strait relationship in the last couple of years is one of the good news stories in the region and the world, which is why it doesn't get that much attention, because this is Gresham's law in news, that bad news drives out good news, and so people don't pay much attention to it. But it is absolutely, I mean, this has always been potentially the most explosive issue in U.S.-China relations, and to have the cross-strait relationship on a good and positive plane and track is something that we can all welcome. I would expect on the trip that we would look for opportunities to reinforce that trajectory. We think that the two sides, Presidents Hu and Ma, have done an excellent job in reaching out to each other and building a framework that we hope will be durable for resolution of differences. Our policy on arms sales to Taiwan has not changed, and that will be evident over the course of our administration. I'm sorry, was there another element in the question? Am I missing any? About core interests? The issue of Taiwan's status, which I guess is what the PRC sees as the core issue, has been addressed thoroughly in the three communiques that we negotiated, and U.S. policy is also is driven by those three plus the Taiwan Relations Act. That framework is unalterable. We're not going to touch it. There will be nothing we say or do on the trip that will go in different directions. You know, sometimes there are some areas where it's good not to innovate. This is an area where we have a tried and true a basis for a stable relationship, and we're not going to tamper with that.
Okay. Unfortunately, we've run out of time. I apologize to all of the people who had their hands up that I was not able to call on. But I do want to take this opportunity to thank Jeff for such an outstanding presentation and the gift of his time. But his time is precious, and he needs to get back to work, and so we will allow him to do that. Please join me in thanking him.
We had a really outstanding overview of the trip by Jeff Bader during the past hour, who both conceptualized it and responded to a wide array of issues that came up. We now want to drill down, basically following the President's itinerary as he travels around Asia. The itinerary will take him first to Japan, then to Singapore for the APEC meeting, then to China, and finally to the Republic of Korea. And so we will have presentations basically focusing on each of those stops. I will ask the speakers to give their presentations one after the other, and then we'll open this up for Q&A. I expect the second half of our session to be Q&A from the audience. We really have an outstanding group of speakers to review each of these stops and the issues that will be raised at them. Let me introduce them all at once now, and just briefly, because you're, as Richard Bush commented about Jeff Bader, you're here to hear them, not me. First on Japan, Ambassador Rust Deming. Rust Deming is now at SAIS, where he teaches Japan, but he had a 38-year career in the Foreign Service that included a variety of posts dealing with Japan over quite a period of years. In fact, he's held most of the posts that I'm aware of in the State Department that deals with Japan in one way or another. He's been the recipient of numerous awards from the State Department and also the Department of Defense, and brings a deep knowledge of Japan to this discussion. On the Singapore stop for the APEC meeting, Claude Barfield from AEI will be doing the presentation. He's a former consultant to the U.S. Trade Representative. He does a lot of work on international trade policy, including in China and the rest of East Asia. For the China part of the trip, Ambassador Stapleton Roy will be doing the presentation. Ambassador Roy is now the director of the Kissinger Institute on China and the United States at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars here in D.C. He had an enormously distinguished diplomatic career, including serving as our ambassador to Singapore, to China, and to Indonesia. He was made a career ambassador, an extraordinarily rare honor in the State Department, and he will be giving the overview on China. Finally, Gordon Flake, who is executive director of the Mansfield Foundation, will be addressing the Korea stop. Gordon has a long history with Korea, including spending several years there very early in his career. He joined the Mansfield Foundation in February of 1999, previously was a senior fellow and associate director of the Program on Conflict Resolution at the Atlantic Council, and prior to that was director for research and academic affairs at the Korea Economic Institute of America. He's a regular contributor on Korean issues in the U.S. and Asian press, and he's traveled to North Korea numerous times. So we really have a treat in store for us here. I think each speaker will take somewhere around 15 minutes, and then we'll open this up for Q&A. So let me begin by asking Russ Deming to come up, please.
Thank you, Ken. Thank you for inviting me this morning. What I thought I'd do is begin by just talking about sort of the setting for the visit and for U.S.-Japan relations, which really means the new approach that the Hatoyama government brings to both policy and governance and how that affects the relationship and the Obama administration's reaction to that, and then look at some of the longer-term issues and some of the challenges, and then end by talking about what I think is sort of a structural imbalance between the way we deal with Japan and the way we deal with China, which is of some concern to me. As Jeff said, you know, the change in government, first time really in 50 years that there's been an elected change of government in Japan. And it's a new experience for both the U.S. and Japan. We've become very familiar dealing with the LDP over these years, and then we're now going through a transition. It's only been seven to eight weeks that this has gone on. So it's not surprising there have been a few bumps in the road. The first impression, I think, when the Hatoyama government came in, that there were a lot of points of commonality between the new government in Japan and the new government in the U.S. And indeed, during his campaign, Hatoyama capitalized on the Obama victory in the U.S., the wave of democracy, a wave of change, not shy at all about making that connection. And both leaders emphasized the importance of global issues, climate change, energy. Both talked about the importance of soft power and the need for negotiations rather than use of military power. So one could argue a basically ideological convergence between the two governments. And the Obama administration, even before the election in Japan, made a concerted effort to single out the importance of the U.S.-Japan relationship. You may recall that the first visit abroad that Secretary of State Hillary Clinton made was to Tokyo, and the first foreign leader that President Obama received in the Oval Office was Prime Minister Aso. And the Obama administration's done a particularly good job, I think, of trying to repair some of the damage done on North Korea, restoring the dialogue and a relationship of trust with Japan. So even before Hatoyama came in, I think a lot of groundwork had been laid. But in the first 8 weeks of the Hatoyama government, the points of difference have come to the surface, partly because of the calendar, because of the budget process in Japan that forces decisions on issues early, partly because of the visit cycle, the president's visit to APEC, a stop in Japan, and other visits that have forced these issues to the surface. It's important to keep in mind that DPJ came in with a deeply rooted agenda for change, which it seems to really mean. And 4 points particularly that relate to managing relationship with the U.S. First, it wanted to rebalance the relationship between politicians and bureaucrats. In Japan, bureaucrats have played a central role in policy formulation. Indeed, the symbol of that before each cabinet member, the vice ministers from the key ministries would get together to approve the agenda for the cabinet meeting, and the cabinet would essentially ratify what the bureaucrats had prepared, and that was the first thing the DPJ eliminated, But more seriously, they really are trying to take power away from the bureaucracy and rebalance that relationship. Second, they want to give local communities more say in issues. They want to devolve decision-making down to local levels and to make sure that local views are reflected in policy. Third, they've talked, as Jeff mentioned, talked about a more equal relationship with the U.S. And fourth, paying more attention to Asia.
just taking these things one by one of how they affect the alliance. Bureaucrats traditionally have been the managers of the alliance with Japan. They have been the shock absorbers. They have been the people we go to work out issues. It's worked very effectively. They've been discreet. They've been skillful. And we've gotten through a lot of bumpy periods, a lot of which I was involved with over the years because of the skill and dedication of Japanese bureaucrats. They have been the primary channel of communication in managing the alliance. Now their role is in question. The bureaucrats are still trying to sort out their relationship with the new government and vice versa. And in the first 8 weeks, it's not clear who speaks for whom and whether the bureaucrats are operating with real authority. And it's caused some confusion, I think, and some lack of clarity in our dialogue. This will work itself out over time. I think fundamentally it's a good thing for political leaders to take more responsibility, but it's a new phenomenon that is affecting, I think, the management of our alliance. Second, local communities, more safe for local communities. Obviously, you know, Okinawa is well represented in the DPJ and in the broader coalition. And when local views are reflected on national security policy, of course, it's a complicating factor. National security policy is decided by national governments, but local communities play a vital role in going along and accepting what it was being done. The Okinawans demanding more say in this. In fact, the governor of Okinawa and the governor of Kanagawa Prefecture, which hosts the Yokosuka, Zama, and Atsugi air bases in central Japan, are in town today and yesterday. And they said publicly yesterday that they have found in the 8 weeks of the new government that they're getting much more attention, getting listened to much more, getting much more access. So that is changing. But again, it complicates the management of the alliance when local governments are playing a more prominent role. Second, the third, the more equal relationship with the U.S. Partly a generational change, a new generation that wants more say, wants a more balanced relationship, a reaction to the Koizumi Bush perception, I think, with many in Japan, there was an overly close relationship. So a natural phenomenon, and one I think that we should welcome, and if it means that Japan wants to play a more active role in support of shared interests and values. But in the first 8 weeks of the administration, it's not quite clear what that means. Hatoyama and the government has made a clear rhetorical commitment to the alliance, but clearly they want to renegotiate or change some of the operational things that have gone on and many of the existing arrangements. So it's a little tricky. And fourth, more attention to Asia. Again, something I think we should welcome. Good relations between Japan and Asia are very much in U.S. interest. It's not a zero-sum game. It should be a plus-sum game. But the question's been raised when the Prime Minister has been quoted as saying that Japan has been too dependent on the U.S. What does that mean? Is this a distancing arrangement, or is it trying to work out a new is Asia seen as a zero-sum game, or can it be seen as a plus-sum game? On the national security agenda, the new government has signaled this out as an area where they really want to do change. Four areas in particular: the Tenma relocation issue that's gotten so much attention. The DPJ has never accepted the arrangement that the U.S. has negotiated twice, first in 1996 and then in 2005 with Japan, the existing arrangement to move the Marine Air Station at Potemkin up north in Okinawa. Second, host nation support. Japan provides about $4 billion a year to support U.S. bases. That's been come under increasing pressure in recent years with Japan's budget crunch and other factors. The DPJ has signaled that out as an issue that needs to be addressed. Status of Forces Agreement, the DPJ has singled that out for change, particularly two areas. One, environment, more control by Japan over environmental issues on American bases, more control over criminal jurisdiction. And fourth, the Indian Ocean deployment, which the DPJ made clear they did not accept and indeed were going to end when they came in. But the coalition does not, and the DPJ does not speak with one voice, particularly on the Okinawa issue, that from the cabinet, the prime minister has said he would like very much to move the Marine Air Station out of Okinawa altogether. Prime Minister Okada has Foreign Minister Okada has suggested moving it into Kadena Air Base. And the current defense minister, Mr. Kitazawa, said, why not just go with the plan as it exists? So there are various different views within the DPJ. And any other coalition members, the Shaminto, the old Socialist Party, that would like to get rid of bases entirely, and the Nihon Shinto it very much supports getting the bases out of Okinawa. So no agreement within the coalition on that. Turning to how the administration here has handled this, I think after a few initial missteps when the spokesman said we're not going to change anything the first couple of days, both State Department and DOD, that it's done a very good job, that the administration made clear it didn't want to back the new government into a corner. It would take time to work these things out. Said there was no deadline for deciding on FATEMA or other things and engage in a quiet dialogue. And we expressed understanding for the Indian Ocean deployment coming to an end, and as long as Japan did something else to help in the region. But then you got into the last few weeks a little public spat when I think people here were very concerned about these statements coming out from various Japanese officials about the whole FATEMA project. And when Secretary Gates went to Tokyo, he made clear in public that we felt very strongly that the existing arrangement was the only practical one to go forward. He also skipped some ceremonial events that were seen by the Japanese as a signal of strong U.S. unhappiness. Now that's been worked back a little bit. The State Department spokesman said the other day there was no deadline. Kurt Campbell was in Tokyo 2 days ago and has said that we are satisfied with the way Japan is handling this issue. So I think, you know, when the summit is setting up for the summit next week, this will not be a major issue of focus. There may be some general discussion about the importance of moving forward, but at the summit, I think, we'll focus on the broader agenda that Jeff has outlined, and we won't see this issue tripping up the summit. Beyond the summit, these security issues will be back very, very quickly. The budget, again, is going to force the DPJ to make some hard decisions on whether to move forward with this thing. Some people in the party have said they want to delay a decision on the FATEMA relocation until after the mayor's election in Nago, which is a city near the new base location, or after the upper house election next July, or after the Okinawa governor's election in November. That's going to be very, very, very hard to push off. So we're going to be faced with this issue, and it may be tricky to manage. Host Nation Support Agreement, the current one, expires in 2011. Already negotiations are going to have to begin on that, so that could be tricky as well. The Status of Forces Agreement, the two governors that are here want to come up with a separate environmental agreement. I hope something like that can be worked out so we don't get into a full-scale negotiation on the SOFA, but again, tricky. And then another issue of just the more subtle in a way of the whole nuclear posture review and the balance that Japan has between supporting the idea of complete nuclear disarmament with concern about the maintenance of the U.S. extended deterrence, the credibility of the U.S. extended deterrence. So we have to manage that very effectively. And then, of course, we have relations with North Korea, China, and so on that all have to be balanced. So from my perspective, I think it's important that we manage these sort of base fundamental issues, that there's a tremendous agenda out there for global cooperation, energy, environment, all the things that Jeff talked about. The U.S. and Japan are natural partners, but unless we sort of manage these basic issues, it's going to be very difficult to move ahead with the broader agenda. Now, let me just mention very briefly this structural gap I talked about. Seems to be much more structure now to the U.S.-China relationship than there is to the U.S.-Japan relationship. You have the strategic dialogue. You have many more American officials going to China all the time. Much more active China-U.S. Business Council. More Chinese students in the U.S. by far than there are Japanese students. The number of Japanese students, in fact, shrinking. And, of course, trade investments patterns have changed as well. China's now our major trading partner, and Japan has fallen back. Same thing on investment. And a very active private sector dialogue between China and the U.S. On the Japanese side, we have an economic sub-cabinet, but in name only. People find it difficult to come up with a real agenda or find issues of real interest. We have a cultural conference, COLCON, so it's trying to revitalize cultural exchanges and student exchanges, but it's having trouble getting money to do that. And parliamentary exchanges are down. Even though we talk about cooperation on climate change and energy, there's no real dialogue, even private sector or government sector, between the two governments. So while some people argue that the U.S. and Japan relationship is mature and sort of can, you know, has its own dynamic, my own view is that it still needs very much top-down leadership and much more energy to go into it. That people, I think, here are distracted naturally by the growth of China and by all the challenges and promises of the relationship with China, but it would be a mistake to not give sufficient attention to Japan to take advantage of all the opportunities that are out there. We have an opportunity coming up next year, 2010, 50th anniversary of the U.S.-Japan Security Treaty. Japan hosts APEC in 2010. The U.S. hosts APEC in 2011. So it would be ideal to get an agenda in place now to try to deliver some real concrete achievements in U.S.-Japan relations in the next year or two. Thank you very much.
Thank Brookings for inviting me to talk about the APEC meetings. When Ken Lieberdahl contacted me and asked me to do this, I thought my first reaction was, well, it's a pretty easy assignment. I mean, there's not a lot that's going to happen. All I have to do is get up and say there's nothing of substance is coming from the meeting and then sit down and ask for questions. Or I thought as I looked at some of the background material, I could focus on the extravagant banquet that the Singaporeans are going to put on, which they are touting as one of the best in years, or the entertainment for the evening of the first evening they're there, which is being produced by the guy who's the judge of their equivalent of American Idol. So they promise an extravaganza of some several hours, that could have been it. I should say that obviously the statement will have the usual pabulum about wanting to avoid protection, even though a number of the countries are violating that on a daily basis, to complete the Doha round, to do something about the imbalances, the sort of things that you've seen in whether it's G20 or APEC or any other meeting of world leaders over the last 2 years. But having said that, I do think, though, that, and this is what I'm going to spend my time on, though I don't think we're going to see much next week, I think this is the process and the institution of APEC is really of central importance to the United States. And I guess I'll start with a little history here as an historian. I think we really, the challenge to the United States and to the nations of Asia really goes back to something that Jim Baker, then Secretary of State Baker, said almost 2 decades ago, in which he said that the United States had no intention of allowing a line to be drawn down the middle of the Pacific with the United States on one side of it and the Asian nations on the other. There have been many times since then that it looked as if the United States really didn't very much agree with that particular administration. I could be bipartisan here, and we drifted away from it. And that leads me actually to a second point that I'll come back to, and that is in the interim, APEC, which was certainly the single trans-Pacific and still is the single trans-Pacific institution, has been augmented by a plethora of not only ideas and institutions, largely for a future of intra-Asian or East Asian, an intra-East Asian economic architecture. And let me just go back, give me the 2 or 3 minutes to kind of roll through the U.S., our varying record in terms of APEC. In some ways, it could be said that, at least until today, that the apex of APEC, as it were occurred in 1994 with the Bogor Declaration, in which the then nations of APEC agreed to move toward free trade in the Asia-Pacific for 2010 by the developed countries and 2020 by the developing countries. APEC was also, and I'll come back to this, a very unique organization in terms of trade policy in that it was not a reciprocity-based process. The so-called concerted unilateralism. The goal was set in 1994, but each nation was asked to move toward that goal at its own pace and through its own means. And that has been the way APEC operates to this day, though I think if it is going to move forward in the trade area at any rate, it will have to change that. But if we look just briefly running forward, this was the, as I say, the high point in the Clinton administration. You then had the what turned out to be a very premature effort by the Clinton administration to move from a unilateral liberalization, as it were, to a reciprocity-based trade liberalization with some six or seven sectors. They were defeated in that in 1997, 1998, and that came just at the time of the Asian financial crisis. The upshot of this, which many Asian nations look to the United States and the IMF as having looked away from them, the upshot of this was for the last years of the Clinton administration, it really turned away from APEC and considered the institution really not worth a lot of time. For the Bush administration, events were overtaken almost immediately by 9/11. And the Bush administration, I'm oversimplifying here, basically from 2001 by about 2006, paid little attention to the economic aspects of APEC. In effect, anti-terror and security issues really dominated. I think it was 2003 that when Bush went out to the APEC meeting, he didn't mention trade at all. He talked only about security issues. And so there was a movement away from the original goals of APEC. Only in 2006, in the second Bush administration, did the administration come back, at least tentatively, to economic issues when it advanced, without a lot of push, at least initially, the idea of a free trade agreement for the Asia-Pacific. And that's where things stand, I think, as the Obama administration comes into office, with one exception, the so-called Trans-Pacific Partnership, which the administration advanced just in last fall, actually. This was a sub-regional arrangement that we wanted to, or suggested that we would get involved with, that included Singapore, Brunei, Chile, New Zealand, and I think now Australia and Peru, with Vietnam also now asking to be a part of the agreement. That, by the way, was a, just as for those of you who are trade aficionados, the Clinton administration had thrown a little dart forward to the Bush administration in 2001 with the Jordan FTA. The Clinton administration wanted to somehow pull the Clinton administration into the labor and environmental provisions that it supported that the Bush administration didn't think would. Similarly, I think the Bush administration, Sue Schwab, knowing that she was not going to get anywhere really or any place forward significantly with this, kind of threw this dart, as it were, forward to the Obama administration, hoping that in some way she would lock them in, or they'd have to make decisions about this fairly early on. That is still a pending agreement. Let me then. This is where we are in terms of APEC. But as I said, the landscape in East Asia, as many of you know, has changed dramatically. And what we have is, and let me just go through the three phenomena that I think are important and that will, I think, have an impact on the context of Mr. President Obama's trade policy in relation to East Asia. And that is a very important set of phenomena has occurred since 2001, and that is the extraordinary growth outside of regional institutions, of bilateral trade agreements among East Asian nations with nations outside of the region. There are now, I think, the last figures I saw, there's some 20 being in some process of negotiation, and 150 have been negotiated. So you have really a changed landscape, and in terms of what nations are doing, but this is important for APEC in this sense. It was always argued in 1998 or 1997 when the Clinton administration came forward with its proposals for sectoral agreements that this was not the way APEC would operate. If the nations of APEC would always go the so-called ASEAN way, in which you went forward at your own pace. Well, in the last eight or nine years, almost every nation in ASEAN and in outside of ASEAN has gone through the experience of negotiating reciprocity-based treaties, trade agreements. And so you have a very different situation if you were to come back to try to do this again. The second thing that has happened, obviously, is the growth of intra-East Asian institutions. That is the ASEAN plus three, which was put forward, which came, just kind of grew slowly in an ad hoc fashion after 1998, and then the Japanese proposal for an ASEAN plus six that came several years later in reaction, actually, to the desire to not be involved, as it were, or entrapped, as it were, in the ASEAN plus three, in ASEAN plus three institution, which the Japanese thought the Chinese would dominate. More recently, bringing us up to our own time, Prime Minister Rudd of Australia has introduced, or has been pushing for the last year, the concept of an East Asian community. Now, he calls it an East Asian community, but he has made very clear, and Australian diplomats have made very clear, that they want the United States at some point to be a part of this. The Japanese complicated matters, or the new government has complicated matters, by also putting forward in the last couple of weeks, in the last month or so, a proposal for an East Asian community, and clearly the DPJ is thinking, at least initially, this will be an intra-East Asian community, not one that would go outside. So you have now a competing set, a whole plethora of competing institutions. And I think sometime in either the first Obama administration and certainly over the next 8 years, whether it's Obama or someone else, I think there will be precipitating events that will move, I think, at least in the economic architecture, towards some sort of regional arrangement. It is hard to know how that will be precipitated. I think one of the things that's outside of what I've talked about is the completion of the European Union's FTA with Korea. A number of economists have argued over the last decade that at any time that you get two of big economies in East Asia that get together for an FTA, the others will have to come in, a so-called domino theory. Now, these economists really didn't foresee the way this may come about, and that is, the thinking was that if it was either the United States and Korea, or Korea and Japan, or Japan and China, in other words, it was that group of nations. The European Union was sitting out there, but the European Union has trumped the others with its completion of the European Union-Korea agreement. Whether or not that will be a precipitating event, I do not know. We're already seeing, by the way, and I'll move on to finally to my final point on this, we're already seeing, in terms of the domino theory, the mobilization of resources and the wonderful triumph, again, of mercantilism in the United States, where U.S. industry groups are saying very, very clearly to the administration, we cannot sit by idly and have the European Union have the kind of discriminatory benefit from discrimination that it's getting from the Korea agreement, whether it's automobiles or chemicals or telecommunication or even agriculture or whatever. So we may be seeing that begin to work out. I do not know, in terms of the Obama administration, it is hard to see, to foretell how they will react to this. And this is my final point. The Obama administration's trade policy, with due respect to Jeff Bader, is still inchoate. And there are solid reasons for this. And it will affect, I think, not just decisions about APEC or free trade agreements out in the Asia Pacific or anywhere else, but our trade policy in general. And that is, at some point, if Mr. Obama is going forward, he will have to confront the fact that he has, at least in the House of Representatives, a majority, probably close to a majority of House Democrats who could be counted not as protectionists. One has to be careful about that, but as certainly global skeptics. And so he's going to have to, whether it's an APEC or whether it's Doha or whatever, confront that situation. And secondly, obviously, in the near term, and this gets us back to the point of what would happen in the next week or so or the next couple of months, there is so much on the administration's agenda, its domestic agenda, with health care and climate change and other things, not to mention whatever the reaction would be to the minor blip, what I would count as a minor blip of the elections this week, that it is very hard to see it moving forward. I think what we're likely to see, and we've already seen, is a continuation of a stream of affirmations of free trade. And we've seen it specifically about CORUS in the last couple of days, or we've seen it about APEC, but not much action. I think action in terms of moving forward in any trade, on any trade front, will go well into next year and possibly to 1911. Thank you very much.
Good morning. There are two ways to look at the president's visit to China, in terms of substance and in terms of context, although I meant to say in terms of context or in terms of substance, because the first involves the strategic management of the relationship, and the second involves the specific issues that will be addressed during the visit. Both are important, but in the grand scheme of things, the first is far more so, namely the context, the strategic management of the relationship. Bear in mind that this is the president's first visit to China. It's no exaggeration to say that presidential visits are not the best way to develop a feel for a country, but they are certainly better than nothing. Fortunately, the president has a half-brother who has lived in Shenzhen for a number of years, speaks Chinese, and has a grassroots view of China and the U.S.-China relationship that the president does not have and will not gain from a presidential visit. So the Obama family has expertise on China, even though the president will be getting his first exposure to the curious Chinese practice of honoring exalted guests with dishes based on sea slugs, shark's fin, and bird's nests. Now, in terms of the management of the relationship, U.S.-China relations are in good shape. President Obama has already had two productive meetings with President Hu. Both sides have set the goal of developing a positive, cooperative, and comprehensive relationship. This is a rhetorical framework, to be sure, but it's a good one. But the biggest challenge in the relationship is dealing with a problem of reciprocal strategic mistrust. Despite the enormous progress that has been made in developing Sino-U.S. relations over the last 30 years, the problem of strategic mistrust has been worsening and is rooted in the behavior patterns of both sides. Evan Medeiros, who works with Jeff Bader in the National Security Council, summed this up very nicely in an article he wrote several years ago when he stated, "The United States and China are shadowboxing each other for influence and status in the Asia-Pacific, rhetorically pulling punches, but operationally throwing jabs. Both are using diplomacy and military cooperation to jockey for positions as the regional security order evolves." The administration recognizes the problem and is seeking to address it. In a speech on September 24th, Deputy Secretary of State Jim Steinberg argued that the key to solving this problem of strategic mistrust is what he called offering strategic reassurance. He defined this as finding ways to highlight and reinforce areas of common interest while addressing the sources of mistrust directly, whether they be political, military, or economic. He put the burden on China to reassure the rest of the world that its development and growing global role will not come at the expense of the security and well-being of others. Now, I would argue that the burden of strategic reassurance rests equally on the United States. It's not a question of one or the other. It is certainly reasonable for the United States and for other countries to be concerned over how China's growing wealth and power will impact on our respective interests. But it is equally reasonable for China to worry that the United States, alone or in concert with other countries, may conclude that China's rise is inimical to our interests and may adopt measures designed to inhibit China's growth. If left unaddressed, such doubts could over time undermine the cooperative aspects of the relationship and launch us in a direction that would entail high risks and high costs and serve the interests of neither country. Our military establishments must deal with worst-case scenarios. That's natural behavior. But leaders have the responsibility to seek to create more positive outcomes, and that is the direction in which leaders in both the United States and China are trying to point the relationship. But you have this underlying problem. So the real test of the president's visit will be whether it contributes to easing this mutual mistrust by providing strategic reassurance in the sense of restoring confidence that each side is considerate of the interests of the other and is not seeking to do it in. The second broad consideration to recognize is how the global financial crisis has altered the playing field. It's too early to draw definitive conclusions, of course, because how soon and how well the United States will emerge from the current financial crisis is still murky. But for the moment, the Asian economies, with China in the lead, seem to have recovered more quickly than economies in the West. This is likely to enhance China's self-confidence. But for his part, President Obama can take comfort in the fact that recent U.S. economic indicators contain positive elements that point toward a partial recovery. These positive indicators, however, have to be weighed against the sobering reality that the United States faces unprecedented budget deficits for the foreseeable future. In my mind, I visualize this by thinking in terms of if the United States were to eliminate our defense budget, we would still be incurring deficits of hundreds of billions of dollars for the foreseeable future. So we are talking about deficits on a grand scale. The Chinese will have these factors in combination permit some preliminary conclusions. First, the reputation of the United States for having the most innovative and profitable financial services sector in the world has taken a severe hit. The Chinese will be less inclined to be lectured to. Secondly, the Chinese have reason to believe that the correlation of forces, to borrow some nice Cold War terminology, has shifted in their favor more quickly than they had earlier anticipated. They are realists, and they undoubtedly still believe that the United States remains and will remain the world's strongest power for the foreseeable future and has an economy that, even in the doldrums, has immense productive power. As a result, Beijing's impulse for cooperation with the United States will remain strong. But in areas of particular Chinese interest, such as Taiwan and Tibet, the Chinese may be inclined to press their positions more strongly than they have in the past. As a result, the management of U.S.-China relations may require some recalibration. Let's turn briefly to specific issues that will be addressed at the summit. These include the global financial crisis, the North Korea nuclear issue, and non-proliferation issues more generally, including Iran, global climate change and collateral issues such as clean energy, the Afghan-Pakistan situation, and specific bilateral projects such as expanding opportunities for American students to study in China. Let's look at these briefly in turn, because Jeff has already covered some of this ground. On the global financial crisis, this was addressed in detail during the first session of the Strategic and Economic Dialogue that took place in late July. And it had a positive outcome. Both sides, if you attended the concluding dinner, were basically delighted with the way that the talks had gone. Both sides have avoided more extreme protectionist measures in the face of the economic downturn, but neither has a perfect record, so there is much room for improvement. The United States has just filed a new WTO panel, a request for a WTO panel to hear concerns that China is restricting exports of various raw materials that are important to the steel, aluminum, and chemical industries. So you can see that our relationship still generates these types of problems. It has three other WTO cases outstanding against China, and China has three outstanding WTO cases against the United States. But at the same time, the meeting of the Joint Commission on Commerce and Trade that just concluded a week ago basically had a positive outcome. It produced MOUs in sectors such as clean energy, tourism, and aviation, so that the urgent need to address the economic issues at the summit will be less than if the engagement between the two sides was not taking place in a substantive basis and in a positive atmosphere. It's also significant that over 80% of American companies that responded to a recent survey report that their operations in China are profitable. The main concern of each side will be that the other avoid actions that would complicate economic recovery efforts. On North Korea, the key issue, as Jeff Bader mentioned, is how and under what conditions to get talks started again. Now, after the second North Korean nuclear test, the North Koreans declared the six-party talks definitively dead, and they celebrated their emergence as an established nuclear power and declared that they were not going to give it up. This destroyed any basis for talks with the North Koreans. But following the recent visit to Pyongyang by Chinese Premier Wang Jiabao, the North Koreans backed away from this position. They agreed to return to the six-party talks, provided there was sufficient progress in an initial round of bilateral talks with the United States, and they reaffirmed the ultimate objective of denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. And Pyongyang has also signaled its desire for Ambassador Bosworth to visit North Korea at an early date. The Chinese believe that a window has been opened for bilateral engagement between the United States and China, and they are eager for the United States to take up this opportunity. So the problem for the administration is whether it can do so under conditions where North Korea has blatantly violated earlier undertakings. And this is what Jeff Bader touched on in his comments earlier. In the meantime, a tough UN-imposed sanctions regime remains in place on North Korea. So North Korea is hurting from the direction in which its policies have been moving. On global climate change, the basic issue is this. If the Chinese and Americans do not show leadership on this issue, the global effort to address it will falter. Other countries simply will not address this issue seriously if the two biggest contributors to the problem aren't prepared to show leadership on the issue. Now, both sides are taking a positive attitude, but it's a long shot that they can agree to measures during the summit that will make the Copenhagen meeting a resounding success. But they already have in place a 10-year framework on energy and environment that was concluded in the final year of the Bush administration, and at the Strategic and Economic Dialogue in July, they produced an MOU on enhancing cooperation on climate change, energy, and the environment. So the question for the summit is, can the two sides agree to a form of practical cooperation on these issues that goes beyond positive rhetoric? That's what we need to watch in terms of the president's visit. The intention is there, but the devil may be in the details. On Afghanistan and Pakistan, this issue is certain to get a thorough airing at the summit because the United States is heavily involved, and China is deeply interested in what the United States is doing. We can assume that President Obama will update the Chinese on the state of the administration's review of its response to the recommendations of General McChrystal. It is also likely that it will urge stronger Chinese efforts to support Pakistan. Nothing dramatic is likely to emerge, but it is important for the two sides to keep open channels of communication on this issue. In terms of specific bilateral initiatives, there may be a number of these, but there seems to be a possibility that they will try to reach an agreement to expand student exchanges between the two countries in ways that will significantly increase the number of Americans going to study in China, with some reciprocity for the Chinese in terms of coming here. I think that's a long overdue step. The Chinese have been flooding the United States with students, and we have only a few thousand students studying in China. It's grossly inadequate in terms of the importance of the relationship for the future. So if they can reach agreement in this area, it would be a very positive development. It is important, in conclusion, that President Obama is making a major visit to Asia during the first year of his presidency, and that he's including stops in both Northeast Asia and Southeast Asia. This reinforces earlier signs that the administration is giving more attention to Asia, which is a very positive development. Thank you.
what a difference 2 years makes. If you think back just 48 months ago in the lead up to the presidential elections in South Korea, you'd be hard pressed to find two allies that, while working together closely on the working level, were more oil and water on political relationships. I mean, if you think about the context of all the controversy you've seen in the last couple of weeks between the United States and Japan about Futenma, that's kind of pillow talk compared to the relationship between the Nomuhyun administration and the Bush administration. And over the intervening 2 years, the election of President Lee Myung-bak in South Korea and the election of President Obama in the United States has really brought both sides back to the center to a remarkable degree of confluence, not only of policy, but position and outlook. And so I probably have the easiest task here. Korea is kind of last on the list in terms of the countries visited, but it's also last on the list not in terms of the crisis faced by North Korea, but in terms of the coordination and cooperation between the two allies and the United States and South Korea. Today, what I propose to do is just focus on the summit itself, President Obama's visit to Korea, starting looking at what might be expected, secondly, moving on to discuss what would exceed expectations, and then finally ending up with a couple of cautionary notes, the sensitivities that may or may not come up that we ought to pay attention to in the future. In terms of expectations, again, it's important to realize that on the issue that had been the primary area of divergence during 10 years of more progressive governments in Seoul, North Korea, there really is not any noticeable daylight between the United States and South Korea in terms of our approach to North Korea. And as a result, I would not expect any major policy pronouncements, any major news to be committed in terms of the alliance. What I would expect, and I think what the South Koreans are going to expect, are some very clear statements that are pro forma but nonetheless necessary. Just to give you an idea, clearly there's going to be statements reassuring the South Korean public of the United States' commitments to the alliance, the United States' commitments to the defense of South Korea in the context of recent North Korean provocations, long-range missile tests, nuclear tests, and an amazing amount of vitriolic over the last year. So again, it's an important opportunity to reaffirm the alliance and the U.S. commitment to South Korea. Secondly, of course, you're going to have a very clarion call for North Korea to return to the six-party talks, and I think Ambassador Bader made that very clear today with his remarks. You're going to also have a clear call for denuclearization. But I would think it's important to put both the six-party talks and the denuclearization in context. I was delighted this morning to hear Ambassador Bader talk not just about the framework of the six-party talks or the context of the six-party talks, but their attendant agreements. And here I think it's worthwhile making a very important point. Back in the ill-fated presidential debates of 2004, when candidates Senator Kerry and President Bush were debating about the six-party talks, it came across as a strangely kind of form over function debate, and it didn't make a lot of sense because at that time the debate over bilateral six-party talks was about strategy, but primarily about format. Now, in 2009, it's really about content. The six-party talks aren't an empty shell. It's not just about 30 people sitting around a big round table. It's about the agreements that were made in the context of the six-party talks. And so whenever you hear an administration official talk about the framework of the six-party talks or the content of the six-party talks or the context of the six-party talks, they're really talking about the September 19th joint statement in which North Korea agreed to return to compliance with the IAEA, the NPT, to abandon all nuclear weapons and existing nuclear programs unilaterally, you know, to go along with 180 other non-nuclear states, as opposed to their current position, which is that they want to be recognized bilaterally as a nuclear power to discuss mutual disarmament. And so for me, the word denuclearization has lost a lot of meaning over the last couple of years because North Korea, in their recent speeches and statements, have made it very clear that their view of denuclearization is global nuclearization, mutual disarmament with the United States. And so I think we need to be a little bit more specific. And I think, as Ambassador Bader was this morning, I presume that any statements that come out of Seoul will be more specific, referring to the agreements of the six-party talks and the context therein. Finally, I think you're going to see the administration, in terms of the North Korea front, pushing for the resumption of North-South dialogue. That's an important nod to the domestic situation in South Korea. In regards to North Korea, there's a broader area, which, again, I was heartened to hear Ambassador Bader refer to this morning, and that is our trilateral coordination between the United States, Japan, and South Korea. Ambassador Bader, if I quoted him correctly, said that from day one, the administration has been scrupulous about building consensus. And again, I admit to being a little bit biased in here, but I think this is the great underreported, underrecognized early success of the Obama administration. All you have to do is remember January of this year, after the election of President Obama, in Tokyo and even in Seoul, there was genuine angst about the Obama administration. And it was based on the presumption that somehow this candidate, who during the campaign had promised that he would be willing to meet unconditionally with dictators, was going to leapfrog over Seoul and Tokyo, and by March 1st have a bilateral summit with Kim Jong-il, and Japan and South Korea's interests would be unmet and unconsidered. That was a genuine concern in our allies in Tokyo and Seoul. And the fact that we are now here in November and that you don't hear a peep out of Seoul, then you've had this remarkable level of trilateral coordination and communication, cooperation, and commonality of policy between these allies, I think has been not only the success in that relationship, but also the key to our success in the UN in bringing China and Russia more closely on board. It's based on the strength of our common position with our allies that we have the real negotiating power that we've been able to utilize during the course of this year. My guess is that will be emphasized, and I do think it's important for that to be strengthened furthermore. Three other short things that I think are likely to be expected during the course of the summit. Clearly, there will be a reference, and there should be, to South Korea's role in Afghanistan. You may recall just last month, South Korea agreed to send a new provincial reconstruction team in addition to their current medical and vocational training team that's gone in Afghanistan. This is in the context of a body politic in South Korea that's deeply sensitive about Afghanistan. You just have to go back a couple more years to the No administration during the hostage crisis that South Korea suffered there, the loss of their own citizens, to realize this is not a popular move. And I presume that South Korea's contribution will be recognized and expressions of gratitude will be given for that. Likewise, I think there will be a notice of and appreciation given to South Korea's leadership role in the G20. President Lee Myung-bak came out strong and early, as you might imagine, in the G20. His role, I think, was recognized not only by the United States, but by other nations, not just in Pittsburgh, but prior to that in London, and even immediately after President Obama's election back in December of 2008 here in Washington, D.C. Lee Myung-bak took the unprecedented step himself of authoring an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal, pushing for some of the key reforms of the G20. So South Korea is really taking leadership role, so much so that South Korea is going to host the meeting of the G20 in Seoul in November of next year. And that remains a very important opportunity and challenge for both coordination between the United States and South Korea, but also between South Korea and our other key ally in the region, Japan, because Japan is hosting just 2 days, 3 days prior to that, the leaders' meeting of APEC. And so now, going back to the issues that Claude was raising, you've got questions of the role both of APEC, of G20, questions of timing, questions of how those things might be coordinated. And I think it's a perfect opportunity for the United States and its two core allies to coordinate this issue economically in the region. Finally, I think I expect there will be a reference to the joint vision statement that came out of the June 16th summit between President Obama and President Lee Myung-bak here in Washington, D.C. Ambassador Bader referenced this. There's clearly been a lot of work done to implement the alliance-based element of that joint vision statement. If you haven't read it, I'd urge you to go back and read it. I noticed he's flipped out of here, but Scott Snyder with the Asia Foundation, they have a Center for Korean Policy Studies, has launched a remarkable project that looks at the whole range of regional and global elements of the alliance, which weren't there before. Traditionally, the U.S.-Korea alliance was all about North Korea. It was all about the peninsula. And now we have, you know, pandemics and climate change and international terrorism and a whole range of issues where the U.S. and the ROK are looking to expand in a truly strategic partnership in the world. I think that's worth looking at. To move on briefly and talk about what issues might exceed expectations, which I don't expect to be raised. I'd like to see them raised. And obviously, one of those is the free trade agreement. Because of the political situation here in the United States, regardless of the president's own support for the concept of free trade conceptually, there really has been no perceivable movement on the CORUS FTA for the first year of the Obama administration and for the first 10 months as we are right now. And I think it's probably unlikely to happen in Seoul. This is clearly something where Korea has put an awful lot of investment to it. I think anyone that's looked at it from an economic perspective finds it to be, you know, a truly high-quality free trade agreement that really says an awful lot about the future United States strategic role in the region. So something that needs to move forward. Unfortunately, all politics is local, and all politics now are healthcare and maybe after that, climate change. So I agree with Claude that there are some very real, blocks in the Congress to this issue. But this is an issue that I think if there was further statements of encouragement, if there were further statements of support in principle, commitment in principle, and again, they've been said so far, but any reemphasis I think would exceed expectations and would be welcome as we move forward. Secondly, further discussions on climate change, and in particular in Korea's ambition to green growth. Korea's interpretation of the climate change debate has not been so much on kind of targets like Copenhagen or Kyoto for emission targets, but really kind of a Seimaul Undong or an industrial policy type revision to kind of look at how Korean businesses and the Korean economy can reduce its own climate footprint. But it's an interesting approach. The Lee Myung-bak administration has invested an awful lot into it, and so any reference to that I think would be a welcome development. And finally, going back to the North Korea problem, President Lee Myung-bak has proposed a grand bargain. An approach to North Korea is still relatively undefined, but in the course of a summit last month with Prime Minister Hatoyama, he got Prime Minister Hatoyama to sign on to it to say he supports the grand bargain. Similar, although slightly more vague statements out of Won Jae-bao in terms of approaching North Korea. I don't anticipate a lot of focus specifically on the grand bargain, but any reference to that from a South Korean perspective at least would be validating for the Lee Myung-bak administration. So let me wrap up. Let me just talk about two issues that are sensitive. One, just to go back to it, FTA. I think we do have somewhat of a window. I think the South Koreans have internalized our own domestic problems here. But if this is an issue that keeps getting pushed off and pushed off and pushed off, particularly in the context of ongoing trends of FTAs throughout the region, it really does call into question the United States' commitments to the region. In other words, if we cannot ratify an FTA of this quality, you know, of this scale, with one of our closest allies in the region, what does that say about the United States' role in the region, particularly economically writ large? And so that is an ongoing sensitivity. It may not come up this time around, but I do think it's something that we ought to address first and foremost. And then finally, the troubling issue of the transfer of wartime operational control. Again, I've been assured it's not likely to come up at the presidential level of the summit, but there is still deep-seated anxiety in South Korea. And to give you just a 30-second overview of the issue, you may recall that this was an issue that was raised during the Nomi administration by the No administration as an issue of sovereignty, taking sovereignty back to the United States. And I think they fully anticipated they would get strong pushback from the administration, but under Secretary Rumsfeld at the time, they were pushing on an open door, and the Americans said, fine, it's yours, you can have it next year. And obviously, the South Koreans said, no, we want it 20 years from now. And eventually, they negotiated down to 2012. But there's still some very deep-seated anxiety in South Korea about their preparedness for the transfer. And I think there's a real need for there to be some you know, ongoing, and I'm sure there is, but even more vibrant discussions on the issues. But all said, I feel in a fortunate position compared to the three previous panelists in terms of the situation in South Korea. Thank you.
We're going to get our panelists mic'd up here so that they can sit where they are and handle questions from the audience. While that's happening, let me just comment that as I think about both Jeff Bader's presentation and then what we've just heard, it seems to me that two major themes are two themes surrounding the trip are one that the U.S. is back in the engagement with Asia business big time, and secondly, diplomacy matters. And so we're going to pursue an approach that really is sensitive to Asian perspectives, Asian concerns, and obviously along with our own concerns. We've had presentations that have covered both the contextual issues and actual trip dynamics. Would welcome questions on either of those dimensions or anything else you want to raise that is within this broad sphere. As with the Q&A after Jeff Bader, please identify who you are. And what your organization is, and feel free to address your questions either specifically to one or another member of the panel or to the panel as a whole, and we'll see who wants to chirp up in response. So with that, let me open the floor. Scott, do we have a microphone up here, please?
Scott Harold from the RAND Corporation. I'm wondering, Ambassador Roy, if you can speak to the F-16 question with Taiwan. We've had panelists talking about China. We've talked about Japan. We've talked about the ROK. Obviously, we have a longstanding unofficial relationship of the last 30 years with the ROC. That's a very important relationship in a lot of dimensions. They share values. They play a very important intelligence-sharing role. And we have a commitment under law to provide Taiwan with the means to provide for its own defense. The Taiwanese Air Force is growing weaker and weaker while the Chinese are growing stronger and stronger. And so the F-16CD issue is a very big issue in that relationship right now. I wonder if you could comment on where you see that heading under the Obama administration and if anything is going to happen in the aftermath of this trip, which some have speculated will be kind of the push-off of this issue until after the president has met with President Hu. Could you comment?
I think Jeff Bader already provided the context for answering your question. Number one, he said there has been no change in U.S. policy on arms sales to Taiwan. And number two, he referred to the fact that tensions are at an all-time low in terms of the last 15 years. So the urgency of the question depends partly on the context. And the context suggests to me that the administration has time to weigh whether or not F-16s are necessary in order to meet the intent of the Taiwan Relations Act. And that's the way I would expect them to handle it.
Thank you. Yes, back here, sir. Yep.
Ken Knaus, Fairbanks out at Harvard. I'd like to talk to Ambassador Roy, please. Do you think the United States vitiated any of its authority when the president decided to postpone his meeting with the Dalai Lama?
No.
No.
I think we already have precedents of presidents meeting with the Dalai Lama. To meet with the Dalai Lama right in advance of the president's visit to China would have been viewed by over a billion Chinese as an affront to China. So it struck me as common prudence for the president not to have the meeting at that time. And my impression is that those considerations are understood on the Tibetan side as well.
Yes, sir.
Xinxin Li from Observatory Group. I have a question for both Mr. Barfield and Ambassador Roy regarding the U.S.-China trade relationship. In my view, the U.S. trade policy hadn't been very coherent since Obama took office, despite of a repeated pledge against protectionism in different multilateral and bilateral forums. We have seen increasing protectionism sentiment domestically in U.S., including the recent punitive measures against the Chinese goods. So my question is, how do you expect President Obama to reassure Chinese side during this trip on their concern about the U.S. protectionism? And also, do you expect any breakthrough in this trade and economic relationship as projected by U.S. Secretary of Commerce and Gary Locke in the recent GCCT meeting? That didn't mean the U.S. recognition to China's status of market economy, or is just less control on the U.S. High-tech exports to China? Thank you very much.
Cloud, do you want?
Well, there are a number of things that you skipped over in there. First place, I don't really think there is a great rise in sentiment protection in the United States. I've written against the things we've done and against some of the statements coming out of the labor unions and even some Democrats and some Republicans. But I don't think, not only in the United States, but I think around the world, well, you have to be careful. We really haven't had, and if God willing, we are moving out of the recession, I think the pressures will decrease. As to the U.S.-China trade relations, I actually think, and again, I wrote against the administration in terms of its tire decision, which I thought was wrong. But in general, I think it's pretty good. And somebody mentioned the fact that we have three cases against the Chinese and the WTO, and they have three against us. I see that as a salutary way of handling things, because that's what the WTO is for. Now, the Chinese have gotten on their high horse in the last year when they've had cases come against them. But I think it's because, and I also think that they know this, but the dirty little secret was that for the first 5 years after they got into the WTO, there was a kind of understanding among the major nations of the WTO that we would not inundate the WTO with cases against China. That the dispute settlement system really couldn't handle, there was a lot of things you could have done. By the time you get to 2006, 2007, whether it's the United States or the EU or Brazil or others, that period of grace, as it were, was ending. And so as China, and by that year, by the way, China had a lot of its obligations were stretched out to 2006 or so. So it was there, at that point, they were supposed to be fully engaged in WTO rules. And I think what's happened is that you have had an increase in cases. But you have cases against the United States, the EU. We are major trading nations, and any major trading nation is going to have cases against it and will also bring cases. So I think that is a positive, result. I think what the president will do in China would be to assure or try to assure the Chinese that he does believe in free trade and that he will not countenance a swing toward protectionism in the United States.
Let me add 3 points. I'm having some problem with short-term memory, but I cannot recall the last time the United States had a coherent trade policy. Secondly, the tire case had nothing to do with trade policy. It had everything to do with the domestic politics of the health care issue. Thirdly, this is a two-way street. It's not a one-way street. If you talk to the American business community, there is enormous concern about actions that China is taking that have the effect of protectionist measures in terms of our access to the Chinese market. So both sides have a problem in this area. Both have not gone to the extremes that they are capable of, but both have big room for improvement.
If I can just add a footnote to that. Well, I'm sorry.
I would say this with both the Clinton administration and the Bush administration. One can disagree with the priorities they had and what they did in trade policy, but I think there was a coherent trade policy. The United States has had one across many administrations, that the multilateral system is our first priority. We have recently added to that regional and bilateral FTAs. But the world knows that. We don't live up sometimes to our priorities, but I think it's in there. And my only point about the Obama administration, and I've tried to say every time I've spoken about this for the last 9 months, though we're coming to the end of this, for Christ's sake, these guys have only been in office for 6 months. So, you know, there are a lot of people who are not even in place yet. That is no longer, I think, you can no longer defend them in that way. And I think at some point in the next year, whether it's with APEC or the CORUS, as Gordon said, or with Doha, the president's going to have to bite the bullet, and it's going to have to be Mr. Obama himself. Because he, unlike Bush, faces a very divided party, and he's just going to have to take it on if he wants to do it.
If I could just add a footnote, I think that protectionist pressures in both the U.S. and China are going to grow greatly over the coming year and a half to 2 years. I think this issue is going to become really a critical issue. Carol Hamrin,
George Mason University. On human rights and religious freedom issues, under the second Clinton administration, we made a big effort to try to make this an area of cooperation between China and the U.S. under the rubric of rule of law. In Obama's visit, as Jeff mentioned, we'll take what is kind of step one, leading by example and talking about American values. But given that China's under a lot of international public opinion pressure to do more regarding Sudan and Burma, Korea, human rights issues there, and given how central democracy and human rights are to our interests in Afghanistan, Iraq, Pakistan, everywhere, it seems to me we're missing an opportunity if we don't have a more robust effort to engage with the Chinese on this.
Carol, I think that's a perfectly valid viewpoint. My experience, however, is that if we are not perceived by the world as setting a good example, that pressure and rhetoric on the subject are viewed as hypocritical and lose their impact. That if we do set a good example, then exposure to our society is far more effective than rhetoric. So I really do believe that getting our own act improved is the key to having a significant impact on human rights practices in other countries. I cannot recall any significant long-term improvements in human rights that have resulted from outside pressure on countries as opposed to internal development in countries where long-term improvements in human rights require changes in domestic attitudes. I cannot think of a strategy that foreign countries could use in the United States to force us to improve areas where we are deficient. If other countries can't influence us, how are we going to influence other countries? That's the problem. And so I think that the administration is going to give it attention, but I think the approach they are taking probably merits time to see whether it works.
Yes, sir.
Jim Goodby from the Brookings Institution. A question for Russ Deming. There's always been a kind of a tension between Japanese interest in nuclear disarmament and Japanese interest in the nuclear umbrella. Given the new administration in Tokyo and this administration's in Washington's attitude towards nuclear disarmament, how do you see this issue playing out in the next couple of years?
I think that's a very interesting issue. The Japanese are you know, quite conflicted about it, partly depending upon where they are on the political spectrum. Just one anecdote, I was in Tokyo in June, and I met with a senior foreign ministry official shortly after the president's Prague speech. And he said to me, I hope now the U.S. can support Japan's annual resolution at the U.N. General Assembly on nuclear disarmament. And the U.S. had either abstained or opposed over the years. Japan had been a co-sponsor almost all the time. And then the next morning I was having breakfast at the Okura Hotel, and an academic friend of mine on the more conservative side ran over to me and said, don't you dare let the U.S. support the Japanese resolution. That will undermine the whole concept of extended deterrence. And you may, in the Asahi Shimbun this morning, a Japanese newspaper, there's an article quoting James Schlesinger, the former Secretary of Defense, who was part of a panel on the nuclear posture review, engaging with some Japanese, again, on the conservative side. And he reported to the Asahi Shimbun that the Japanese were very concerned about moving forward with nuclear disarmament in some way, undermining the whole credibility of the U.S. nuclear deterrent. So it's a very delicate issue. And I think that there needs to be a good dialogue. I think Kurt Campbell's already started one with the Japanese in the context of our nuclear posture review to make sure we don't do things there that could undermine the credibility of our alliance.
Okay. Yes, sir. Over here.
Gil Rosman at Princeton. I want to ask about a possible Bosworth visit and whether that will produce more division between South Korea and China and how they would like us to handle the North Korean issue. I got the impression that there was some optimism from the comments that were raised that we are going to manage our relations with these two countries better in dealing with North Korea. And yet it seems to me that what China and South Korea are after in terms of their strategies for dealing with this are quite contradictory. And that there's a very good chance that we'll see in this approach that China is pushing for a very soft approach to North Korea in order to concentrate on talks with denuclearization a little vague and uncertain until we get farther along in the process, and that is the opposite of what Im Yong-bak has been seeking. So I wonder if you anticipate that problem and you see how we can handle it.
Gordon, despite your saying that there was really no real news in the visit to South Korea, I think we've got a question for you anyway.
One thing that's true is that it's a lot easier to coordinate a policy when the policy is to do nothing or to put pressure on North Korea. And the real challenges will always come once you begin the process of negotiation, because then the different nuances, as you're describing, in terms of the policies come out. One area where I might disagree slightly with what Ambassador Roy said in terms of his discussion of the Chinese visit, Wang Jiabao's visit in particular, is I think the Chinese themselves recognize quite clearly how little they got from their visit to Pyongyang. You know, Wang Jiabao went, because it was the 60th anniversary, he went bearing a lot of gifts to the North Koreans. And in the end, Kim Jong-il gave this vague worded statement about he's willing to come back to the six-party talks, did not mention denuclearization, did not mention the agreements of the six-party talks, no agreement to return to compliance. He essentially said, if the United States recognizes us as a nuclear power and we see progress in our bilateral relationship, then we'll come back to your silly little six-party talk thing. And clearly, that's not a lot of progress on the North Korean position. It's really no change whatsoever from their previous position, with the exception that they were willing to utter the hated words, highly conditional six-party talks, right? And I actually think if you look at the Chinese blogosphere and the Chinese analysts, even before Wang Jiabao came back, they were quite critical of what Kim Jong-un had given. So I believe the Chinese recognize that full force. It's a matter of face. You know, you can't say that Wang Jiabao visit failed. So you can't come up and say, oh, he got nothing from the North Koreans. You've got to say the ball is now in the American court. But if you push it pretty hard, I think there's a clear recognition throughout the region, both in Seoul and in Beijing, that the ball remains firmly in North Korea's court, that North Korea has not yet made a strategic decision to return to compliance with its previous agreements. And that remains a common challenge for both Beijing and Seoul. But I think, Gil, you're absolutely right. If there does pan out to be a Bosworth visit, and if there is the initiation of some form of diplomacy, therein lies the real challenge in coordinating our policy. It's not when we're putting pressure on them.
Several points. Hi.
Please.
One, there have been differences in the media coverage in North Korea and in China of the visit by Premier Wang Jiabao. But in private conversations, the Chinese do not describe their visit and the accomplishments the way you have put it, Gordon. They are very explicit that they did back away from the positions that they had publicly taken after the second nuclear test. And the Chinese media has openly covered it that way, referring specifically to denuclearization on the Korean Peninsula, linking it to the Kim Il-sung legacy commitment, which was not in terms of general disarmament, but in terms of Korean Peninsula per se. The Chinese would welcome a visit by Ambassador Bosworth to North Korea because they believe that a bilateral connection between the United States and North Korea is necessary to get back to the six-party framework, which they think has to play the crucial role in bringing about the agreements. The problem with any approach to North Korea is if hardline approaches worked, we wouldn't have a problem. If softline approaches worked, we wouldn't have a problem. The question is how to find the right balance so that you can actually get progress in the right direction. I think that for other countries to preach to the Chinese about how to deal with their very difficult neighbor doesn't make much sense. The Chinese have more experience in dealing with the North Koreans than other countries, and their experience is public hardline postures toward the North don't work, and that you need to always use your iron fist with a silk glove around it, and that's the way I interpret the Wang Jiabao visit. To have Kim Jong-il publicly repudiating positions that they had publicly asserted just a few months earlier, I don't think the Americans could have produced that.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
Size visiting scholar. A question to Ambassador Roy. President Obama will talk with Chinese leaders, Hu Jintao, maybe Premier Wang Jiabao, about many issues. I think, you know, those issues are the global level, regional level, and domestic levels, such as, you know, the global financial crisis, global climate change, North Korea nuclear issues, Iranian nuclear issues, Asia-Pacific cooperation, Afghanistan, many issues. Those are involving the global and the regional level. They will also talk about, you know, issues which are involving domestic level, such as human rights, trade imbalance, currency exchange rate, environmental protection, freedom of media, freedom of religion, democracy, rule of law, access information, minority policies. Many issues from, you know, three levels, global level, regional level, domestic levels. My question is, do you think, you know, the United States recognize China is a global power? Because, you know, many issues, both China and the United States involving, you know, from the global level, according, we are the studies of international politics, global level, regional level, and domestic level. Do you think, you know, the United States has already recognized China is a global power? Okay, thank you very much.
You've answered your own question. You have described the agenda for the talks. We don't have that type of an agenda in discussions with many other countries. With China, we do have that agenda now, and it involves the big issues that we are confronting both globally and regionally. So there's no question in my mind that we recognize China as a global power now.
Yes, right here.
My question is about the Korean Free Trade Agreement, which I think is a great idea. But my recollection is that when we were getting close to a deal, there was massive protests in the streets of South Korea, which I think has to be a consideration. I mean, you know, I want free trade, but I also want democracy, right? So how deeply unpopular is this in South Korea itself? And something that I really don't understand is, why is it so much more unpopular than free trade with Europe, which actually seems to be extremely popular in Korea, from what I can tell? It seems like there was no street protests over the European... I mean, I think the reason that the EU has beaten us to this is that despite the Bush administration's advocacy for it, it was unpopular, whereas in Europe wasn't considered... For whatever reason, it wasn't the unpopular things.
You know, despite the assertion in some circles politically in the United States that it's bad for our president to be respected overseas, I tend to agree with what Ambassador Bader was saying this morning. If you have a president who goes in, he's enormously popular in the domestic politics of the country. It gives us an awful lot of leeway and influence on a whole range of issues, from security to trade. Obviously, during the course of negotiation, remember, the deal has been negotiated. The deal is done. Right? This is a question of ratification, both in South Korea and the United States. There was opposition both domestically in the United States and in South Korea, and that's to be expected in any negotiation, right? The primary demonstrations you saw in South Korea, there were some early on, but the primary ones were after the deal had been negotiated, and they were primarily focused on the beef issue, and it was all a domestic safety issue. And it really turned into an anti-Lee Myung-bak administration. So if you look back to the spring of 2009, earlier this spring, and the tremendous street demonstration took place there, they really weren't anti-Bush even, or anti-Obama, or really even anti-FTA. They really were about the decision-making process of the newly elected Lee Myung-bak administration, who was kind of hearkening back to some old ways of decision-making in a country that had changed dramatically over 10 years, had become much more open, much more democratic, and much more used to what they call participatory democracy. And then when you mix all that together with some out-and-out lies that were told, where there has been prosecutions of journalists about the beef issue, and the way the government handled it, and the sensitivity of the issues to average mothers, it really blew up in his face. But I wouldn't characterize that as an anti-FTA demonstration. Now, clearly, there's some opposition to the FTA within Korea. When the key committees in the Korean National Assembly tried to ram it through in the summer, I think you may have seen the attacks with chainsaws in the committee door and fire extinguishers. There's a lot of passion. But opinion polls still show across the board 70 to 80% support for the FTA among the South Korean public. Yeah, and that's quite remarkable, given the fact that Korea gave an awful lot and a lot of different sectors in that agreement. Yeah, because the Koreans rightly view this as a strategic deal. It's economic, and the economic benefits, and I think Claude can speak to this, are almost beyond contestation across the political spectrum, right? But beyond that, this is, linking the economies of the United States and South Korea together in a way that I think people view as beneficial to both countries. And it really, in a world where, as Claude mentioned, there are now 120-some-odd FTAs, many of them that China has been leading, I wouldn't consider FTAs. I think they probably are more trade exclusionary by nature than that. So to have competing models of what an FTA is, and for us to have one of this quality out there and not move on it, really says an awful lot about our leadership. And so I think the South Koreans are willing partners. They're just waiting for the go from us. They're waiting for the green light from us. That applies to the government, and that applies to the body politic writ large.
Thank you.
I think the danger is, though, that this, as long as it's not ratified, it's hostage to events. You could have other events, as you say, that had nothing to do with the FTA come up, and that would be a vehicle for opposition. So, I mean, there's another reason to get forward, I think, with this. And certainly, and all the economic analyses, I mean, that
for all our faults, we have a more open economy than the Koreans, and particularly in services, particularly in agriculture. So it was all, that's a one-way street, I think.
Thank you very much. I think I'm going to call this to a close. You've all been here for 2.5 hours, and I hope you found it as useful as you had hoped. And I want to ask you to join me in thanking, you know, State Roy, Gordon Flake, Todd Balfour, and Russ Deming.